Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
You're listening to All of It on WNYC. Welcome back to the show. There's a new art show at the Wallach Art Gallery up at 125th Street. Posing Modernity, the Black Model from Manet and Matisse to Today. It re-examines the depiction of women of color within a history of modern art from the 19th century forward. Manet, Degas, Baudelaire, and Matisse are all represented, and all create works where Black women were central to the work. Posing Modernity looks at how some of the same themes explored by the Impressionists took on new life during the Harlem Renaissance, and how themes of representation, class, and social structure explored then are ripe territory today. The show was curated by Denise Murrell, PhD, and a Ford Foundation postdoctorate research scholar. Co-organized by the Wallach and the Musée d'Orsay, the show will be on view in New York through February 10th, 2019, and then it will be expanded into the Musée d'Orsay in Paris in March. Denise, welcome.
Thank you, Allison.
So this show originated from your doctoral dissertation.
It did.
At Columbia. Can you tell me what that dissertation was about and why you chose that subject?
Well, the dissertation was essentially this subject. We actually shortened the name a little bit. We just had to get that down. It was essentially a survey of the legacy of Manet's portrayals of the Black model Laure, including in his iconic painting Olympia of 1863. And part of what I wanted to do was build awareness for the fact that that was by far the most famous of his portrayals of Laure. But he made two other images of her, and he painted another woman of color, the biracial actress Jeanne Duval, who was the longtime mistress of his friend, Joël Baudelaire. So you have this moment in 1860s Paris at the beginning of modernism, not just in art, but in popular culture, in music, in literature, when there was this Black presence represented by these Black women and by other models at the very heart of this advent of modernism.
I want to continue on with that, but I think your background is so interesting. So you had this successful career in business. You were an analyst at Morgan Stanley, got an MBA from Harvard Business School, investment positions. How did you end up in the art world?
That is an interesting question. And how much time do you have? But to truncate, I had a business career for a long time, quite a while. But alongside that business career, I always had this avocation of going to museums and seeing art. And part of it was, you're a young professional in New York, and the museums, the companies we worked for, had this free admission for employees. And there were these support groups that you could join, pay a small fee, and you got to have evening receptions and walkthroughs of exhibitions with curators and visits to emerging artist studios. So it was a very passionate avocation for me for many years. I also traveled a lot with my job, mainly in Europe, so often for extended trips, 2 to 3 weeks. And I had lots of opportunities on weekends and downtime to browse the museums of London, Paris, really all over Europe, repeatedly for a number of years, and came across some of these works in galleries and became curious about them.
That's fantastic. I just love that idea that you had this thing you were passionate about and decided to go ahead and go for your PhD. That's awesome. So let's talk about the beginning of the exhibit. It represents this changing significance of the Black female figure. Can you tell people the first image that we see and why?
Well, you walk into a gallery and there are the first image that you see directly before you is Manet's portrait, his portrait of Laure. Laure was the model the Black model who portrayed the maid figure in his famous painting Olympia. And that portrait is not very well known. There hasn't been a lot of scholarship about it. But what's important about the portrait is that first you kind of see the beginning of Impressionism in the way he paints her in a very specific way that presents her as this very, dignified, kind character who really engages just the viewer, but also in his studio notebook or carnet for that painting, he describes her. He tells us her name is Laure. He describes her as une très belle négresse, a very beautiful black woman. Négresse, of course, has pejorative connotations. It was the common uses of the day. And he told us where she lived. And that was a real clue for me because I recognized the address as being right there in the heart of the neighborhood where Manet and the Impressionist Monet Renoir lived and worked. So we have a wonderful, large painting by Bazille, who was an acolyte of Manet, loaned to us by the Musée d'Orsay, very graciously, that shows these artists, Manet, the Impressionist Renoir, Monet, and Bazille, in Bazille's studio, right in that neighborhood, just a stone's throw from where Laure lived. So that kind of gave me the sense of this racially mixed neighborhood in this emerging Paris, which, by the way, the timing of this 1863 was just 15 years after the final French abolition of territorial slavery. You had people coming from the French Caribbean, mm-hmm. especially to Paris. There was always a small black population there. But that was perhaps the beginning of another aspect of modern life in France, which was the build-out of a black community that is very present if you go to Paris today mm-hmm. in that neighborhood, and especially going east toward the Gare du Nord.
So was there a tension among the artists, or maybe a sort of an awakening among them in terms of the way that women of color were portrayed prior to this period?
I think there was. I don't necessarily think it was by specifically focusing on race, per se. It was the broader mandate of modernist artists emanating from Manet himself mm-hmm. that rather than painting traditional scenes from history, biblical scenes, mythology, artists should be painters of modern life. His friend, the poet Charles Baudelaire, wrote a treatise saying that artists and writers, the most important project of art was to convey, to project the life of everyday life around them. And so Manet's exhortation to the Impressionists was to not stay in the studio, to go out into the streets around them and to roam the neighborhood and paint every single aspect of it, you know, high, low, everything in between, the aristocrats, the brothels, the homeless, and give all of these aspects of life the same dignity, human dignity, as traditional art had only bestowed to aristocrats and the elite.
We're talking to Denise Morel. She is the curator for Posing Modernity, the Black Model from Manet and Matisse to Today. I'm interested in, at what point did women of color, black women, start to become, show prominence in paintings? They always talk about in history, when you see certain paintings, there's always the famous painting of Belle, mm-hmm. the one that's in the castle, where she's in the equal status with her mm-hmm. with her half-sister. Mm-hmm. The same with the Indian gentleman that that they realized there must have been more to their relationship because they are equals in this
yes.
painting. When did
mm-hmm.
that start happening?
Well, you do see episodes of this equality or relative social equality beginning in this modernist period. It was part of the Republican sentiment prominent at the time that was against empire and the enslavement of other peoples. It was all part of that movement. But certainly at this moment in 1860s Paris, Manet and the Impressionists were reacting against these often very beautifully painted Orientalists. Scenes, typically depicting harems, often imagined harem scenes from North Africa, from East Asia. And they were scenes with, a nude white odalisque being attended to by a bare-breasted black servant who was really serving this woman. She's bending, she's working, she's washing her, etc. So I think Manet is still being honest in portraying playing sex trade, the sex trade in these high-end brothels that were right there in his neighborhood in 1860s Paris. But he moves the black woman from this exoticism into French attire, into an interior that is right there in the neighborhood, and places her on a much more egalitarian basis pictorially with the Odalis. You have a sense that they're friends. She's consulting with her. She's not just serving her. She's bringing her a bouquet of flowers. And so you see that kind of egalitarian over the successive generations of artists just becoming more and more commonplace, and the servant-employer relationships sort of recedes after the abolition of slavery, after the end of empire, many decades after that, and with the advent more and more of artists of color and of an overall political sentiment in the wider progressive thinking culture that we want to portray an egalitarian between races and ethnic groups. And that is part of what makes modern art modern.
It's so interesting also in the show, it's not just paintings, there's photography as well. Tell me about the inclusion of photography.
Photography was really important for me, and it was something of a discovery, because when you look at fine paintings of this period, the artist's objectives until Manet and the Impressionists was to be shown at the Paris Salon, an annual display of what was deemed at the time great art. It would be comparable to the Whitney Biennial today. So young artists who wanted to have a career made works that fit the conservative academic taste of the judges for the Salon. And that fit into all these tropes of the, you know, the servant employer, et cetera. But as they decided to embrace modern life, they moved away from that and increasingly showed the multiple roles. But you see this even in the earliest periods in photography. One of the things I tried to show in the exhibition is that Nadar, the Impressionist photographer, friend of Manet, he made iconic images of Manet, Baudelaire, that are famous. But many people of color, many black Parisians from all walks of life, came through Nadar's studio as well. And they sat for poses that project them as elegant, dignified, stylish, enigmatic. And I wanted to use the photographs to show that these images and paintings are not just symbolic. They represent, they index a lived reality of these people who are right there in the same social and artistic circles as Manet, as Baudelaire and Nadar, as well as in the same neighborhood, literally.
I became fascinated with Degas' representation of Miss Lala.
Yes.
I'd never seen anything like that from him. Will you explain to me what this is? It's really lovely and amazing.
Yeah, and her existence and the fact that,
Explain to people who Miss Lala is.
Yeah, Miss Lala was a very well-known, very famous and well-paid circus star in Paris. She was black, of Prussian origin, mixed race, actually, of Prussian origin. And she became one of the top stars at the Cirque Fernando, which is very elegant, small-scale circus in this neighborhood near Place Pigalle. And the elites and avant-garde of Paris went to that particular circus in the same way they went to opera and ballet. And she was feted as this. She undertook these death-defying feats. The one that Degas portrays, she's being raised to the very ornate ceiling of the Cirque Fernando, suspended only from a device clenched between her teeth. It's portrayed in popular culture as emblematic of the stereotypical, brute strength of the black female, whatever. But Degas portrays her in very much the same manner that he portrays the ballet dancers, which is, those are the images he's famous for. We think of Degas, we think of ballet dancers. And he shows the artistry that is behind every act of great athleticism. The way she deliberately arranges the placement of her feet and her arms and her hands, very similar to that of a ballet dancer. And he portrayed her several times, far more, as far as we know, than he worked with any one image of a ballet dancer. So I think bringing this into the way we think about Degas as a painter of ballerinas, but also as a painter of this famous black woman, Miss Lala, is very important.
The show moves from the late 19th century Paris to the Harlem Renaissance. What is the connection? That's a connective material.
Well, there is, and this is another thing that I wanted to kind of bring to the fore. There's a pretty longstanding narrative of African-American artists in the early 20th century, 19-teens, 20s through 30s, making long visits to Europe, especially to Paris, to study study the old masters at a time when racial discrimination really limited opportunities for black artists to have a career here. And but at the same time, in America, in the U.S., the Great Migration was happening. 6-7 million African Americans were leaving the rural South and moving to New York, Chicago, forming new cities. And in the heart of this was the movement now known as the Harlem Renaissance in literature and poetry, but also in art, where these African American artists came back to the U.S. And use all the skills, the artistic skills that they had acquired to portray everyday life in these new black cities of Harlem and Southside Chicago, and to, in an environment, in a time when the predominant imagery of black people in popular American culture was just outright racism, stereotyping, blackface, all of that. So you see these very dignified portrayals of a matron, of a young woman who is elegant, who's debonair, who's not hamming for the cameras, who's maintaining a certain sort of distance, an engaging distance, but showing interiority, showing a life of the mind, moving beyond all the stereotypes of the anti-intellectual stereotypes of African Americans at the time. And this, so we know about the Harlem Renaissance artists going to Europe and then coming back. We know less about School of Paris artists, and in this case, particularly Henri Matisse, who together with Picasso was the co-founder of the School of Paris, coming to the U.S. on several occasions in the 1930s. He was going to the Barnes Foundation outside Philadelphia to make the famous dancer murals there. But during each of his four visits, he made extended stays in New York, and he was feted on the front page of the New York Times, visiting the Met, being feted by the Rockefellers. But unknown, except through letters to his family, was the fact that in the evenings, most evenings, he was going to jazz clubs in Harlem. He was seeing black theater.
Matisse in Harlem is just, it's like, what an image.
That whole idea. Yes, and we have a wonderful image by Carl Van Vechten. Carl Van Vechten, we think, was the main connection, in addition to the fact that Matisse's son, Pierre Matisse, was a very well-established gallerist in New York at that time. But Van Vechten was, on the one hand, very close to many of the founders of the Harlem Renaissance, like Alain Locke and Paul Robeson, and the Matisse and Robeson families knew each other. He was controversial. Other Harlem Renaissance writers felt that he was playing to stereotypes by bringing the downtown white intellectuals like F. Scott Fitzgerald, et cetera, uptown to see blacks, you know, in clubs, et cetera. But there was an overall feeling that this cultural exchange, in the long run, at least, had benefits. And I saw that benefit in Matisse's own work, because in the following decades, he had the opportunity to work with a number of black models when he made illustrations for a new edition of a book that Charles Baudelaire had written in the 1860s about his biracial mistress, Jean Duval. And so Matisse engages, in particular, a black Haitian dancer, Carmen Lyons, to pose for a number of these images. And you really see the sort of vacillation between tradition and modernity in his portrayals of her. Some of them look like a woman who could be walking down the streets of New York City today. And then he made paintings, easel paintings, of a Belgian Congolese journalist that are among the finest of his late easel paintings. And he made two very important cut paper, cutout paintings of the African-American dancers Josephine Baker and Catherine Dunham, who at the time, we've forgotten a little bit about Catherine Dunham today, but in the 1940s, she was just as famous and feted in Paris as Josephine Baker was. So Matisse really was the School of Paris artist who engaged with African-American black modernity in Harlem and with the black French populations.
The name of the show is Posing Modernity. It'll be on view through February 10th at the Wallach Art Gallery. I encourage you to get on the one train and head to it. It's a great show. Denise, thank you so much for joining us on all of it, and congratulations on the show.
Thank you so much, Allison.
Coming up next, we're breaking down that Sheryl Sandberg buzzword, buzz phrase, lean in. This is all of it. This is all of it on WNYC. You may have heard Michelle Obama wrote a book. Yeah? You may have heard about that. She's on a book tour. And earlier this month, at an appearance at Barclays Center in Brooklyn, the former first lady said, quote, "That whole so you can have it all? Nope, not at the same time. That's a lie. And it's not always enough to lean in because that bleep doesn't work all the time." She quickly apologized for her language, saying, quote, "I forgot where I was for a moment." 5 years after Sheryl Sandberg's book Lean In was published, many women are finding themselves agreeing with the former first lady's statement. And in light of that, we want to talk about what's changed, if anything, for women at work and how the sentiment of lean in has changed following the revelations about Sandberg's work at Facebook. And some people actually calling for her resignation. Joining us now are Catherine Goldstein and Professor Khadijah White. Catherine Goldstein is a journalist and a 2017 Harvard Nieman Fellow. She's also the host of the Double Shift podcast, which will be coming out in 2019. Hi, Catherine.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Of course, and Khadijah White is a professor in the Department of Journalism and Media Studies at Rutgers University and the author of Branding Right-Wing Activism, The News Media, and The Tea Party. Hi, Khadijah.
Hi, thanks for having me too.
Okay, I just wanted to find out, first of all, Catherine, what did you think about what the former first lady said?
Well, when I heard about Michelle Obama's quote, I found myself sort of vigorously nodding in agreement. And I think probably many people that quote resonated with her, but I think what was maybe different about me is that when the book first came out, I was really all in on Lean In, and I took Sheryl Sandberg's message really seriously and even created my own Lean In circle, and my views over the last 5 years have really changed.
You wrote that you were a super fan, a 29-year-old hard-charging New York social media strategist and editor. So how hard did you lean in?
I took the message so seriously. I created my own Lean In group and leaned into that. And we met for a year and sort of followed the lesson plans. And I was happy with what I had accomplished in my career, but I knew that I had a lot of ambition. And I thought that this was going to be a blueprint for success for me as I sort of thought about how to continue to grow as a professional. And, you know, there are some messages of the book that I think still resonate. For example, a number of the women in our group asked for and got raises sort of following Sheryl Sandberg's advice. So I do think that there are some important lessons about negotiating and speaking up for yourself that that still resonate. But I definitely took her lessons very seriously.
Okay, also I want to let our listeners know is if you'd like to join this conversation, our number is 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. Did you lean in? How did it work out for you? What do you think? Do you think it doesn't apply anymore? Khadijah, let me bring you in. What were your impressions of the book Lean In and Sheryl Sandberg's overall advice when it came out?
Well, I didn't get too far into the book, though I understood why it was appealing to a lot of people. And, you know, I think it's because a lot of people are really eager, especially women, to feel like they have a lot more control in the workplace. And that gave them, you know, it was a self-help book. It felt like it was empowering, and it allowed people to really think about what can I do to make a difference in my own life. And America is at it through a meritocracy. We're all looking for ways to kind of believe that if we work harder, we can get ahead. So I understood that that's kind of the place it had, that it started a lot of important conversations about why women were falling behind still, how women could get ahead. And so I do want to say there's a place for it. There's a place for the book. But I also didn't feel that motivated to read it because it seemed all in all from what I could tell and you know, the first chapter or two that I read of the book, that it was mostly kind of generic advice about believing in oneself and getting ahead.
So Catherine, you mentioned that you really leaned into this. You had a lean in circle. At what point did you realize, Catherine, I'm sorry. At what point did you realize this wasn't going to work out the way you thought it might?
I became a mother. So, I came to some different crossroads in my career. I got offered a really exciting new professional opportunity that was going to have more money and more responsibility. And this like really seemed like my lean in moment. And so I went for the job and I left behind a family friendly company where there was a lot of working parents to be the only working parent on my team in a very traditional office. And I faced a lot of struggles. I had a son that was born with health issues and he's thankfully very healthy now. But, you know, I wasn't really ready to go back to work when my very short maternity leave was up. And I really struggled with sort of what my professional identity was. I went on to lose that job and I came to see myself at the time. It really felt like I was a failure and everybody had this working mom thing figured out except for me. And I've sort of now as I've turned my attention to this as a journalist, I realized nobody has it figured out. And it's not just the systemic lack of support that working mothers get, but also a lot of very, very open discrimination that mothers face in the workplace that I've been researching and reporting on for the last couple of years.
I think you bring up an interesting point. I want to bring Khadija in this, that one of the criticisms of the book was that she was in such rarefied air in her position that she wouldn't necessarily experience some of the discrimination and difficulties that Catherine described. Khadija, what do you think about that idea of Sheryl Sandberg sort of speaking to a, in a way to a very small group of people?
Yeah, no, I mean, I really love that Catherine talked about motherhood and even that Sheryl Sandberg's book starts with motherhood because, you know, in essence, her book is a kind of trickle-down feminism text, which is like if you get more women at the top, then policies will change and things will get better. And this idea that fear is holding them back. And when you talk about motherhood, you know, that's something very concrete, right? That's not just like fear or lack of ambition holding one back. That's actually thinking about kind of how we care in our nation about what it means to raise children, what it means to be in the workforce, what it means structurally to help tend to families, which are, you know, how our nation keeps growing and how we stay strong. So I think it's really important for us to think through that and to consider the ways in which Sandberg, you know, embraces this capitalist notion of feminism that is about corporations and benevolent corporations that supposedly will help everyone. And I think, ironically, that means that for Sandberg, and when you're looking at kind of all the controversies around Facebook right now that Facebook is mired in, we see the lie of a benevolent corporation, this idea of a business that, you know, is just good, is there to be a good for everyone. And you see, you know, that really a lot of these corporations are in it for themselves, and that's ultimately how women get treated when they have children and when they're seen as kind of not being as present in the workplace as some corporations want them to be. So, you know, this is, you know, structural issues and the ways in which Sandberg really kind of avoids talking about structural issues for women in the workplace is at the crux of the criticism around Lean In and the thing that we have to keep coming back to.
Let's take a call. Holly is on line one calling us. Hi, Holly. What's your story?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was slightly connected to what your last speaker was talking about. I work in the nonprofit sector, and I'm also a single mother. And so when I read the book, I was like, this is not applicable to me at all because I don't have the same type of resources to be able to have a husband or a partner who's going to be able to, you know, take on the child care when I need it. And in the nonprofit, we're really overrepresented by women in general. So I thought it was a very specific look on certain sectors in the workforce and just really wasn't applicable to a lot of women in our country.
Holly, thank you so much for weighing in. Our number is 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. Were you someone who bought, leaned in, and read every page? Were you somebody who bought into the idea? Do you still buy into the idea, or maybe you have changed your minds? We're having a conversation about this with journalists Catherine Goldstein and Professor Khadija White. You know, it's sort of, there was an interesting part, the way that book opens, I had to remind myself, is it's when she, I believe she was working at Google, and she was, like, profoundly pregnant, and she had to park very far away. And she describes herself waddling in to the founders of Google and demanding maternity parking, and they sort of shrug and say, okay. And her point, I think, was that sometimes you have to ask for things you want, and sometimes some of these barriers aren't necessarily sort of have been malevolently concocted in some boardroom. It's just that they're 24-year-old guys who have never had a pregnant woman working with them. What do you think about that aspect of it, Catherine, this idea that sometimes it's just ignorance?
It's definitely just sometimes just ignorance. And I think having people in leadership positions consider the needs of people at all stages of life with all kinds of caretaking responsibilities, not just the idea that mothers need special treatment, but that you should be thinking about all kinds of needs for employees. I think that's important. But I mean, my feeling is that the problems facing working mothers go so beyond getting pregnancy parking. And I think what Lean In doesn't address at all is this idea that it's not just like, oh, there should be some perks and a few little benefits that can really help mothers. You know, if you have a baby between 25 and 35, which are your prime childbearing years, your earnings never recover. For every child a woman has, her earnings drop, and for men, they actually get a 6% bonus in their raises. Like, that's what patriarchy looks like, basically. So the idea that yes, it's important to have women at the top, and this sort of corporate trickle-down feminism can have a few perks, but a CEO or COO is not going to lead a social movement. Those are people who are invested in the status quo.
We've got a call on line two from Mount Pleasant, New York. It's a Catherine as well. Hi, Catherine.
Hi, good morning. Good afternoon.
What would you like to add?
Well, I wanted to add something to the comments that were just made, because the one issue that always pops up with Leaned In is raising children. And Anne Morrow Lindbergh, Charles Lindbergh's wife, addressed the stages of a woman's life 50 years ago. And she described the stage of an older woman as being a mollusk, where everybody is clinging to your back. So at that stage in your life, when you're 50s, when you need income the most to provide for retirement and college, you may still have children, but you may also have a disabled family member who you will be caring for your entire life. You may have aging parents with Alzheimer's who are moved in with you, where their situations only get worse. I had all three at once. Children and a mentally disabled family member and a mother living with me with Alzheimer's. Of the three, the mental disability is the worst, because eventually the children moved out, thankfully. And sadly, eventually parents die, but the disabled family member, I have that responsibility willingly for life. And that is completely ignored in all these conversations.
Catherine.
You know, everybody forgets about us.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for bringing that up. I think that's really important to bring up. I mean, to her point, a lot of people talk about, I've heard the mollusk before, or the sandwich. You end up being a sandwich person with somebody on each side, having to take care of people. Catherine, I know you write about motherhood and caretaking a lot in terms of getting ahead in your career and maintaining your career. Do you think there's a way that Sandberg could have approached this book with a better understanding?
Well, it's interesting because, as listeners may know, Sheryl Sandberg's husband unexpectedly and very tragically died after she wrote Lean In. And she wrote something very thoughtful about how people criticized her for not, addressing the realities of single mothers, and she didn't really get it until she was in that situation. And she said, I didn't know what it meant that, you know, you can't lean in at work when you're overwhelmed at home. And for that, I give her credit for her humility and sort of admitting that. But I think that this is an example of just having people with really diverse life experiences, you know, both leading companies and leading conversations is really important, and just not sort of defaulting to basically very privileged, very wealthy, elite white women as like the central focal point of the drivers of this conversation, I think is really important, because then we get a much, much wider diversity of experience, and we're not just only talking about Sheryl Sandberg doesn't take up all of the airtime.
Let's go to Ellen on line three. Hi, Ellen.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm calling. I retired about 5 years ago, and I had my children in the early 80s at the age of 26 and 28. And I believe that I did have it all, and a major factor in that success was the collaboration with my husband. And we took turns when one of us had an especially demanding thing going on at work, then the other one took more responsibility for the house and the children, and vice versa.
Ellen, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts. We're speaking with journalist Catherine Goldstein and Professor Khadija White. We're discussing Lean In 5 years later. I did want to bring this up. We're going to go to some more calls, but I did want to bring this up with you, Khadija, because you're a media scholar. I wanted to take your temperature on this shift in perception about Sheryl Sandberg most recently, now that she's Facebook's, you know, COO, and all that we have learned about her role in terms of the investigations about Russia and the way she has conducted herself and conducted her business. Do you think this has affected her brand, kind of, for lack of a better word?
It's an interesting question. I mean, I think, you know, I tend to agree with, there was a New York Times piece on Sheryl, on kind of the way in which Lean In has lost its brand in light of what's going on with Sheryl Sandberg. And it closes with a quote from one of the people who works for Lean In, where she basically says, you know, that there is a study that indicated that women sometimes have a leg up over other candidates because women are perceived as having more integrity, being more honest. And when you have someone like Sheryl Sandberg, who is very, very well seen, very well known and high profile, being seen as someone who lacks integrity, that you know, she doesn't finish the sentence, but the inference there, obviously, is that it can start to affect even this one advantage in which women might have over men who they're competing against in corporate spaces. And so, yeah, I think, you know, obviously it kind of makes you, I think what it does is it draws your attention to the fact that Lean In was in part a brand for Sheryl Sandberg. It helped promote her, it helped get her name out, it helped give her visibility, and that it really relies on this, you know, as a scholar, we call it neoliberalism, this idea that, you know, individualized market solutions are better to solving the world's problems. And you start seeing, actually, you know what, maybe Facebook does not solve the world's problems. Maybe it makes it worse. Maybe it needs regulation. Maybe we need government. And those are the kinds of conversations that we have equally in the workplace, right? Maybe we need government to say, no, women need to get this much time off. No, we need paternity leave. No, we need better Family Medical Leave Act. All these things that we talk about in relation to women are really issues about our society and how we need to have better rules in place to help develop and create people more humanely around all circles of their lives.
We're going to take a couple of calls. And Dennis, I'm so happy a fella called. Dennis from Montclair. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. You know, I'm a mid-60s professional father, and I've got two young daughters. One's just beginning her career, so to speak, and one's just about to. And, you know, fathers don't necessarily have, I mean, I have a professional wife, but we don't have the same appreciation of what women go through or need to go through as women do, because we didn't live it. And I'm just wondering, could you give any advice, I know it's slightly off point, to fathers mentoring their young professional daughters?
Catherine, you want to take that one?
That's a great question, and I love the idea of more fathers trying to seek out that question, the answer to that question. I think that you know, I think instilling confidence and belief and encouraging young women to follow their dreams are always great advice, and as a parent, it would be, I think, applicable to in many situations. But I think also, you know, I think preparing women for the fact that, like, that sexism is real and that things in their worldview, if they're not totally attuned to that. And honestly, I think women are in the workplace are more attuned to that than they were even 5 or 10 years ago because of the Me Too movement. But helping them understand that, forces at play in office politics and that sexism is very real and that they shouldn't feel like it's their fault. And I think, you know, being an open sounding board to discussing those kinds of things and hearing their experiences and validating them, I think could really help them get ahead in the workplace. And, you know, if they choose to become mothers, like also helping them and supporting them navigate that transition as well.
Thanks for calling, Dennis, and good luck. I think your daughters have a nice dad. Let's talk to Tricia in Manhattan. She noticed something about the lean-in movement she wants to point out. Hi, Tricia.
Hi. Can you hear me?
I can.
Okay, great. My situation is different, and from the moment I started reading the book, I read the whole thing, but I didn't feel it applied. And I feel like it's a really specific group of people, as you said earlier, that it applies to. I'm a single female. I'm a woman in my 50s. And my other single colleague is, we're the last ones that are allowed to leave at any given time, because people say, well, you don't have children to get home to. You don't have a family, so you can work the late holiday hours. Or even my male colleagues who are married without children, they have to get home to their wives. And the single guys just leave. So there's a perception that single women are going to be the ones to always pick up the ball, which, again, if we're about trying to equalize the workplace, you have to take into account people who have families, but I'm single, that doesn't mean I don't have a life.
Thank you so much for weighing in, Tricia.
And I would say, I was going to say, it doesn't even mean that she doesn't have a family, you know?
Absolutely. As we start to wrap this up, I wanted to get your take, give you both each a moment to really think about what should be, I guess this is a little bit of an essay question, what should be or could be the 2018-19 version of Lean In that would be useful? What do you think, Catherine?
Oh, well, I really think that what I hope to see for 2019 is, instead of, is expanding from the Me Too conversation, expanding the Me Too conversation to moms too, and to try to further sort of enfranchise mothers into a larger feminist conversation. And so people don't see talking about moms, issues that mothers face and discrimination mothers face, as a niche issue, but something that all feminists should care about. And that's sort of what I've committed to with my podcast, The Double Shift, which is a narrated and reported storytelling show about working mothers.
Looking forward to that. And Professor White, your last thoughts?
My last thought, well, you know, one of them is, I don't want to skip over the idea of the single woman. I think what it has to be is, you know, what is it, pushing to the workplace, right? Get these workplaces to really think about how to treat all of its employees humanely, to give them fair working hours and regulations. My friend and PhD who works on artificial intelligence, Rachel Thomas, writes about tech culture, and she, you know, really pushes work environments and tech to think about how to evaluate people differently, how to evaluate women and men in ways that are fair to everyone. But I actually, as a professor, as a scholar, I want us all, particularly the Sheryl Sandbergs of the world, to really turn back to thinking about how regulation, how policies in the workplace, in our society, advocating for them on a high level, are really important for everyone. We have to have fair family leave. We have to have humane working hours and working conditions.
Professor Khadijah White and Catherine Goldstein, thank you so much for joining us for this conversation. It was really interesting, ladies. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
After the break, my colleague Andrea Bernstein has been right in front of the courthouse this morning where Michael Cohen was being sentenced. Now she's back and about to be sitting across from me. We'll hear what it was like at the Michael Cohen sentencing right after the break. You're listening to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. Just this morning, Michael Cohen, the president's former lawyer and fixer, was sentenced to 3 years in prison and went down right here in Manhattan, just down the road from our studio. And WNYC's Andrew Bernstein, co-host of the podcast Trump Inc., asterisk, which just won a DuPont Award. We'll talk about that a little bit, too. She just got back to the office, and this is her first stop. I was on Twitter, Andrew, right up until showtime. What happened?
So it was super emotional, and one of those situations where I felt like I genuinely don't know what is about to happen, and that is so rare in life. Something is happening right in front of you of major national significance, and you don't know which way it's going to go. So the first thing that happens is Michael Cohen's lawyer, Guy Petrillo, stands up. And when I say stands up, I mean he is tall and thin.
Yeah.
And he makes the case, look, Michael Cohen might have done wrong in his life, and he acknowledges that, but now he is cooperating with the special counsel, and the future of our democracy depends on you, Your Honor, sending a signal that people are rewarded for cooperating, because otherwise we'll never figure this thing out. Okay, that's a paraphrase, but that is essentially what he was saying. And then the special counsel's office sort of took a more kind of neutral position, and they said, okay, yes, well, first he lied to us, but then he helped us. And they said he helped us on matters core to our investigation of cooperation by the Russians in the 2016 elections. They were quite explicit that Michael Cohen helped them on that. And then the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District said he committed a different kind of crime against democracy by violating campaign finance laws and these hush money payments. And if you don't punish that, you're going to send a signal in all the next elections that that's fine and that it's fine to steal millions of dollars from the U.S. taxpayers. So it was a real kind of crucible of justice situation there. And none of us really knew what was going to happen until the judge pronounced his sentence of 3 years.
Yeah, that sounds, it sounds dramatic. I don't want to oversell it, but
it was pretty dramatic. And I mean, then there was just another incredibly stunning dramatic moment. And excuse me, I literally just got back from the courtroom, so I'm just flipping through my notes here. So Michael Cohen stands up and he starts to talk and he says, my own weakness and blind loyalty led me to a path of darkness, he says, referring to Donald Trump. He said, this is somebody who I went to work for, someone whose business acumen I admired. Now I know there was little to admire. And then he says, I mean, something quite extraordinary. I had to sort of go back and reread it. He said, time and again, I thought it my duty to cover up his dark deeds, referring to Trump. He said, Trump called me weak, and he was correct, because I did this. And to me, that's so extraordinary, because the first that the sort of world heard of Michael Cohen was in connection with the dossier, this collection of unverified intelligence in which Michael Cohen was alleged to have played a role of covering up. Not exactly what he pleaded guilty to today.
But he used the word cover up.
The fact that he said that was my function was a sort of extraordinary validation of sort of everything that's come out and all the reporting that's been done about Michael Cohen and our own frustration about getting information, us, you know, personally and the Trumping team about trying to understand this, that he was the person who was sort of dropping down the Iron Curtain of information to prevent us from knowing the truth.
Judge William Paul, I said Cohen committed, quote, a smorgasbord of crimes. What's on the smorgasbord?
So there was several counts of tax evasion by deliberately hiding income. There was making false statements to a financial institution because he lied about his debt when he was applying for a home equity loan. Most famously, two counts of campaign finance violations for paying for these two separate and complicated hush money schemes, which we all know about, and lying to Congress. But what the judge said is there is this pattern of deception that is threaded through all of this. And I should say, I was sitting there. I always get to court dates early. I was sitting right in the front. And then they actually moved me inside the sort of bay. So I was as close to Michael Cohen as I am to you, which is about 5 feet away. And his daughter was right there. And she started to just sob at one point and sort of quietly cry through this whole testimony. And you could see at one point the sort of genuine connection between the two of them. And, you know, here's this guy and he's committed these crimes that affect the fate of the world. And here's his daughter who is heartbroken sitting right next to me crying about it. And you sort of feel the full realm of this sort of Shakespearean, you know, play that is sort of playing out right before us.
Because he's a man with a family.
He is a man with a family. There was a lot of his family there. They all seemed quite stunned. Even though the sentence was a reduction from what he could have gotten, they seemed quite stunned at that he is going to go to jail. He had asked for no jail time.
So there's not a sense of relief for three years.
It did not seem in any way. I think that seems to them very bad.
So does this conclude the Stormy Daniels, Michael Avenatti chapter?
I'm going to guess not, because it's still inconclusive what exactly Trump's role was. I mean, now we have a federal judge saying that these payments were made specifically to influence the outcome of an election. So that's a different level of sort of truthiness than we've had up to now. But we still haven't fully played out what Trump wants to say and if Trump committed any crimes here and how that's all going to play out. So
that was my next question. Right. How does this pertain to the Russia investigation and so to what Mueller's doing?
So the Russia investigation, they have said he will continue to cooperate with them. And the special counsel was quite clear. Michael Cohen has been very helpful and continues to tell us things that we want to know. What exactly those things are, as with the special counsel, we know when they want us to know.
Now, I know you're not a lawyer, but you're very smart and you cover all this stuff. So if Cohen continues to cooperate with Mueller, and let's say he really cooperates with him going forward, could his sentence be reduced?
It's possible that there's some legal byplay, but it did not seem today. There was no sense of we're going to challenge this, we're going to appeal this. So based on what we know now, he is going to jail for 3 years. He's going to pay $500,000 in restitution, $100,000 in fine, and pay the back taxes of $1.4 million. He's going to go to jail in March. Could that change? As of now, no one seemed to indicate that they were going to try to make it so.
Andrea Bernstein, thanks for the play-by-play. And again, WNYC's Trump Inc. podcast won a DuPont Award yesterday. It's a huge prize in journalism, and we cannot let it go without saying congratulations to you and your whole team. Nice job. Well deserved.
Thank you so much, Allison.
You've been listening to all of it on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. We will see you next time.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.